This is Teddy Roosevelt, just back from charging up San Juan Hill. Damn it, Professor Buzzkill was already at the top, collecting historical evidence, busting myths, and taking names. I have to admit that he's a worthy competitor and a damn fine rough rider. Join me in listening to this episode. It's sure to be bully.
Yes, it's Professor Buzzkill here, busting myths and taking names and trying to introduce you to the complications of history. There's so much talk these days about the radicalism of the Republican Party and about the rhetorical shocks that seem to come out of the mouths of leading GOP politicians in the era of Trump, even in this post-Trump presidential period. But is this a brand new thing? Politics has often been nasty in American history. But when did this particular style of Republican extremism start?
With us here, Buzzkillers, is the perfect historian to explain all this to us. That is Dr. Julian Zelizer from Princeton University, who is the Malcolm Stevenson Forbes Class 1941 Professor of History and Public Affairs at the Princeton School of Public and International Affairs and the History Department. Thanks for coming on the show, Professor.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we have you here today because all of this partisanship seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. And your book, Burning Down the House, Newt Gingrich, The Fall of a Speaker and the Rise of the New Republican Party, is coming out in paperback very, very soon. And we thought this would be the perfect time to ask you about how all of this started, or at least the modern version, the contemporary version, the version we see now. And you and a lot of other analysts have traced this to Newt Gingrich and Newt Gingrich's allies. They have tainted American politics in your analysis. Why do you see it as a problem with him and the way that he and his allies approach politics in the late 70s, early 80s?
Well, in my mind, there's two big stories. One is starting in the 1970s, American politics generally became more polarized. And that resulted from a number of different things, from the way gerrymandering started to work to the way the parties organized themselves on Capitol Hill. And you had a diminishing number of centrists, and the parties moved further apart on key issues. And that affected everything from decision making in Congress to the way the media works.
Right.
But then you have another story, which is how did the parties polarize in different ways? And how did the Republican Party gradually become radicalized in terms of how it was going to conduct partisan warfare, meaning not abiding by any kind of guardrails, diminishing the role of norms or any kind of constraints that existed, even in a world of partisanship. And Newt Gingrich was really quite important. He comes in the 70s and 80s. He's a young maverick. And he not only makes the argument that Republicans have to be willing to be much more aggressive and much more toxic if they were going to achieve power, but he wins the support of the Republican leadership and himself becomes Speaker by 94. So he's really a pivotal figure from that era in the 50s and 60s to the era in which we are today.
And, you know, a lot of people might think that this is sort of your book is sort of a screed, a political screed against what you're upset with in terms of the tenor of American politics. But what I think people don't understand is you've heavily researched this book. This isn't just some sort of knee-jerk reaction to something that we all remember, but also that seems to be making things so bitter. Can you tell us how does a historian like you go about researching something that is A, within our lifetime, and B, so fraught with contemporary, that is, at the moment problems? You know, how do you handle yourself at dinner parties when people ask you, you know, when you were working on a book on Newt Gingrich? Do you have to sort of be careful and say, well, you know, and try not to upset anybody or try not to start a fight when you don't want to start a fight? What I'm trying to say is how this is an extremely scholarly book. How do you then try to show people that, you know, this is a serious problem? You're not just being partisan. You're not just being incendiary.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, in terms of a book like this, two things drive me. One is what other scholars have written on a period. And so it doesn't come out of not liking Newt Gingrich at all. It comes out of both trying to understand polarization and then trying to understand what social scientists call asymmetric polarization. Why did one party differ in how it conducted itself as opposed to the Democrats? And then B, it's the archives. I mean, this is heavily based on his archives and his record, which he has an amazing archival collection, as does the person he takes down in my story, Speaker Jim Wright, who is a Democrat. Mm-hmm. And I really I mean, the book evolved and the story evolved not from any preconceived notion of what this would all be. I knew about some of the episodes in the book from my own studies. And it grows out of that. And then when I'm at that dinner party, it's actually quite common, although I haven't been at a dinner party in a while, yeah. But when they happen, it is a natural question. And I understand the question. In this day and age, everyone, you know, has their radar going in terms of, is someone, you know, writing a serious history or writing a serious piece of journalism, or do they have a partisan objective? And you know, I can't ever convince everyone, but no. I just remind them what I just told you in terms of where it comes from. And I also say, look, if one party becomes very extreme, it's actually more partisan not to capture that in the history of the period.
Oh, right.
Yeah, than it is to somehow put that aside and say, well, the parties were pretty much the same. Gingrich was like any other politician of the period. That actually masks what happened. It's like writing about the 30s and 40s and deciding, well, I'm not going to emphasize the fact that Franklin Roosevelt and the party became quite liberal and expanded government because we want to be more balanced in terms of any distinctions we might draw between the parties. This is the history.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are the kinds of arguments I make. But it is, I mean, it's a harder issue in this day and age because everyone in a polarized era sees everything from history to what you watch on TV through a partisan lens.
And that's one of the reasons why I think we historians have so much trouble with what's called whataboutism. You know, well, they're all the same. They all do that. And if your speciality is looking at Newt Gingrich and looking at the Republicans, then you're almost automatically biased because you're not also looking at the other side. What, of course, in your book, you do look at the other side. But this question of asymmetrical polarization is absolutely fascinating, or asymmetric radicalization. I'd like to come back to that at the end of the interview, but we've gone on too long without talking about Newt Gingrich himself, because we have a lot of listeners outside the United States. And of course, we have a lot of listeners in the United States who don't necessarily know his background. So how did all this happen? He starts off as a very, very minor figure at a small regional college in Georgia, but then eventually becomes Speaker of the House.
Yeah, I mean, he's a guy who grew up in a very troubled family. His biological father left his mother a few days after they got married while she was pregnant. He spends a lot of his time as a young boy traveling around Europe because his stepdad is in the military. Eventually comes back to the States, goes to Emory, marries his high school math teacher, and his family resides in Georgia. Mm-hmm. He gets a PhD at Tulane in history, and then decides academia isn't for him, and he gets into politics. He runs three times, and finally in 1978, he wins a seat to represent Georgia. And yes, he comes to Washington, and he's seen both as someone who's not particularly important. He's ambitious, he's brash, but he's not a leader right away in the party.
Right, right.
And he's also seen by both parties, by Republicans too, as quite dangerous, that the kind of aggressive tactics he's peddling, senior Republicans thought, you can't really do that, because if you do that, you'll undermine our ability, meaning the collective ability of Congress to work. And what the 1980s is about, and that's the heart of my story, is his gradually ignoring those warnings, going after Democrats in pretty ruthless ways, using every procedure of Congress as a partisan weapon. And by 1989, formally obtaining a position of leadership, and then in 94, when Republicans finally win control of the House for the first time since 1954, he becomes Speaker. So it's a story of a guy who breaks the rules in pretty aggressive ways. And it's a story of a Republican Party that, you know, grudgingly, mm-hmm. but actively accepts what he's doing and brings him into the inner circle of power.
Well, and I think that's one of the reasons why your second chapter is called The Political Wrecking Ball. But also, you start the book off by talking about, in the prologue, is called Speak Like Newt. And early on, as you describe the rise of his political influence, you talk about how he deliberately crafted extreme language and almost only used extreme language when talking about opponents. And that, you know, that was not only sort of a shock in Washington, but then it had, as you say, an effect on the Republican Party, his colleagues in the Republican Party. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? I mean, a lot of people just won't remember that it wasn't necessarily like that before. What, for instance, what did he say and how did he get away with it?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about what we're talking is about is that he himself was pretty open in what he was doing. And that was remarkable in the archives. He had memos, he had letters to other members saying, you have to talk like this. You have to be more aggressive. Ignore bipartisanship. It's not as if, as a historian, I had to intuit that's what he was doing. He said this explicitly. And other Republicans said to him, you know, be careful what you do. But rhetoric was very important to him. He understood in many ways how the modern media worked. He's coming in as cable television is really starting to take form. Talk radio, conservative talk radio, is really expanding over the time. And he understands that the words that politicians use are in many ways the best weapons you have. And he was often frustrated. He thought Democrats were very good at the language that they use, that they were consistent, they had a similar platform no matter who you were talking about issues. And he wanted Republicans to do the same. And in doing the same, he said, you just have to be willing to be more ruthless. And he criminalized Democrats. He was willing to call them not just corrupt, but a criminal class, the radical left, the loony left. And gradually, he sends a memo toward the end of my book saying, call Democrats treasonous, you know, and language which at the time wasn't really what you heard. Now it's pretty familiar in part because of President Trump. But he gave them lists of words. This isn't abstract discussion. And his goal was that over time, if people, voters, heard this enough, they would start to perceive of the Democrats not as the party of FDR and LBJ, but a corrupt party that was essentially a continuation of Watergate and everything that had gone wrong in the 1970s.
Well, how do other Republicans finally cave into this? Do they see that it's working and they suddenly have to say, well, that's what politics is like now? I mean, so many of them, you would think this is going to just backfire on us eventually.
Well, they did think that. And some just, it wasn't simply that it would backfire. Robert Michael, who was the House minority leader in the 1980s, just warned it was at some level dangerous. They were still institutionalists around in that period, meaning they believed in partisan times, you still had to govern and you still had to worry about your ability to do so. But Republicans were frustrated. They had not really been in power in Congress really since the early 30s, even though there had been a few moments when they regained control. And so it was seductive to hear this young Republican who said, I'll get power for us. And gradually his techniques worked. And one of the stories in my book is he helps really bring down the Speaker of the House, this guy Jim Wright, in 1989, through one of these attacks where he takes small stories about nothing illegal or even unethical, but shady behavior, kind of things that legislators in both parties did that probably could be better. And he blew it up into a major scandal akin to a congressional Watergate. And they saw it worked. And there were a lot of Republicans, when there's a vote to make someone minority whip, which is a small position, but it's a position of power. In 1989, a lot of Republicans, including people like Olympia Snowe, who were very moderate and pretty civil, they vote for him because they say they want power and it's working. So they went along and they also believed that they could contain it. It's kind of the constant belief of Republican leaders. They can bring in the radicals, and when the time comes, they'll contain the radicals, as opposed to when the time comes, they will be brought down by a new generation of leaders, which is really what happens.
Well, yeah, and the Jim Wright scandal, as you say, was by today's standards, by almost any standard chronologically, extremely small potatoes. It's not something to call him evil and corrupt and all these kind of crazy rhetorical things that Gingrich used.
No, and in fact, as Gingrich is conducting this campaign, he himself is doing things that he's accusing Wright of doing, and arguably yeah, in much actually corrupt ways. He'll later be fined for some of activity. So he's going after Jim Wright for the fact Jim Wright sold some book of speeches he wrote in bulk to different groups. And there was nothing illegal or unethical about it. It was a loophole in the ethics laws, and it allowed members to make more than they could make in honoraria. And Gingrich blows this up, and he really almost makes a federal case out of this, even though, again, the guy who wrote the ethics law says you're allowed to do this. As he's doing this, he himself is being investigated for his own book deal and for taking money from lobbyists in Atlanta, in Georgia, to sell his book. But the thing about Gingrich, he doesn't care. He can live with that kind of hypocrisy very easily. And he understands the key is just to stay on message, stay aggressive, and keep attacking. So it wasn't this actual thirst for ethics that drove Gingrich. It was situational ethics. It was using it as a partisan weapon rather than cleaning up the way Congress worked.
And then this happens again when he talks about sexual scandals among other people, President Clinton and other people in Congress, yet at the same time engaging in sexual misbehavior himself.
Sure. I mean, he has a life that is anything but pure, many affairs and broken marriages. But one of those affairs happens as the Republicans, with him as speaker, are impeaching President Clinton for perjuring himself over an affair. And ultimately, this is part of the reason that Republicans in 98 say, your time is done. You're really not convenient for us anymore. But this is an ongoing story with him of doing exactly what he's attacking others for and doing it in sometimes much worse ways.
Yeah, well, what I don't understand is that, you know, there if anything, as we saw in the famous movie, All the President's Men, you know, there are thousands of political reporters in Washington. The press presumably was calling him out on these inconsistencies and this hypocrisy. But it just never seems to stick, or is he just moving so fast that it doesn't stick or it doesn't matter?
I think he's good. And you asked me earlier about what I say to people when they ask me about writing about. I mean, part of the book is a serious look at him. I'm taking him very seriously and actually presenting him as a very effective leader.
Yes, yes.
And that's part of his effectiveness. There is literally a press conference at the climactic moment of the Jim Wright scandal, where he's being asked about his book deal and he's being asked about very specific accusations. And his answers are just not true. It's different. And he's very good at not being engaged by or provoked by those kinds of allegations. And what he's really good at is then turning it right back on his opponent. And he understands that if you speak more about your opponent than they speak about you, ultimately you'll win over the media coverage. And that's exactly what happens. So he just had thick skin, and he was never scared, really, as those kinds of investigations were taking place.
But one could argue that he's very successful in this, and he changes the Republican Party, and he changes the culture of Washington, changes the culture of political discourse. But in terms of, you know, chronology, he's not on top for that long. He's elected speaker, in 93?
94, and 95 he begins his term, and he's out by 99.
Yeah, so it's, you know, it's within the realm of one presidency, so to speak. But it seems to have incredibly long-lasting implications. I mean,
I think that's a really good point. And I think he doesn't remain speaker very long. He runs for president in 2012. He doesn't do very well. And then he doesn't become vice president for Donald Trump.
Right.
So part of it is a story about a guy who's very savvy in terms of politics, who has a lot of influence on his party, but he himself, as the top person, is not really disciplined enough to keep that kind of position, or he's more comfortable as the maverick, as the attacker, than the person in charge. But there's another side that he was so successful, he created this world where it was just remarkably easy to bring down leaders. I mean, no one was safe in the post-Gingrich world, including him. And I think the ease through which younger Republicans brought him down in 98 at the height of his power in some ways is a reflection of his success. That's the environment he wanted. And that's how he came to power. And gradually the revolution basically ate him alive.
Well, it eats him alive, but then is it also paradigm setting? Is his approach and his rhetoric the reason why we have Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz and people like that saying, you know, completely outrageous things?
Even more. I mean, I believe that the Tea Party generation was very influenced by what Gingrich did. Obviously, Speaker John Boehner, who's kind of an in-between figure, he was part of Gingrich's army during the 1980s. I think the Tea Party, which not only spoke in very toxic ways and used disinformation, they also picked up on Gingrich's belief that all the processes of government were fair game in partisan politics, the ethics rules, the budget. And that's what they use against President Obama. And then President Trump, I think he's directly impacted and actually was advised by Gingrich. And the world that Trump thrived in was really very much based on the foundation of Gingrich politics and the Gingrich Republican Party. I think that's why there was room for him. So yes, I think his influence was incredibly, incredibly long lasting right through now with people like Green or even someone like McConnell, who's quiet. He's not into the rhetoric, but he's into the ruthless use of processes such as Supreme Court nominations, where he doesn't believe guardrails are essential.
He's doing the same thing, maybe not
with the commission
as incendiary.
Yeah.
Well, you call all this mindless cannibalism by the end of your book. And I just wonder, you know, are we stuck with that? Do we need to have the Lincoln Project and all these things are asking for another Eisenhower to come in and water things down and calm things out and make things more sane? But is it too far gone? I mean, it's hard for me to believe as an American that Marjorie Taylor Greene is a member of Congress. It's just hard to believe. But there it is. And, you know, is it just going to get worse? Is this cannibalism going to continue?
I think it will. I mean, that quote, that term comes when Jim Wright, the speaker, he decides to resign in May of 1989. He decides the party's pressuring him. Gingrich was effective and makes this dramatic speech on the floor. And he says to Republicans, meaning Gingrich, stop. I'm stepping down. You got what you want.
Yeah.
And he's telling Democrats, he goes, don't return the favor. Don't return the fire. Stop. And he's saying, if we don't, we're going to get in this terrible cycle of mindless cannibalism. And Wright didn't understand where politics was or where it was going. I really think this is a part of his story. He was an old school politician who didn't see how the rules had changed. And I think we are fully in that period now. And I don't think it will be easy to change. Part of dating this back to the 80s rather than 2017 is to suggest that the way the Republican Party looks now, it's pretty deeply rooted. And I think the Never Trumpers, for example, were really, they're marginal, they're important figures, but they're marginal within the party. And even Liz Cheney, who's so conservative and pretty to the right, also kind of is a story of where the party has landed. So that combined with broader questions of how the media works and how redistricting works, we are in this period of cannibalism for some time to come. There might be cycles where it's a little calmer and others where it's more intense, but the fundamentals are in place and it's going to take real reform and real generational change in the parties to move us into a different space.
Well, can I ask as a way of sort of wrapping up, because I mean, people will criticize this episode, or they'll criticize me at least for making it sound like it's all about the Republicans and they're the only ones to blame. But you mentioned early on this thing called asymmetric radicalization or asymmetric polarization. Can you explain that to our listeners so they understand why we are talking about mainly the Republicans here, the new Republicans?
Yeah, it's a very useful concept that has come up in the last few years. And the point isn't that Democrats don't have extremists in the party.
Right.
The point isn't that there are no Democrats who can be very hardball, underhanded sometimes in how they pursue their politics. The argument is that as a whole, the Republican Party shifted much further to the right than Democrats as a whole moved to the left. And the Democrats still abide generally by more traditional ideas of governance and process. And Republicans in terms of the leadership, has moved into a place where anything goes. And so you can look at the leaders of the party, whether it was Donald Trump, whether it's Senator McConnell, whether it's the Freedom Caucus in the House, and just compare that to someone like President Biden,
right,
or even
right.
Pelosi or Schumer. They're playing two different games. And I think the Trump presidency brought to light what this means. So it's not about, are there elements in both parties? It's about, what does the party as a whole stand for? And where is the leadership? And that's why you talk about Republicans in terms of this kind of partisan politics.
Well, it seems to have not affected Newt Gingrich in the long run. Sure, he never became president, but he's gone on to a presumably very lucrative speaking and pundit career after his downfall in the Congress. So is this only making things worse that you know, you can be like Gingrich and do all these things, and then eventually we're going to have Marjorie Taylor Greene as a new commentator on some extremist show? I mean, is this a sort of, has he blazed another sort of career path for people like this?
I think that's a good point. You now have this whole ecosystem of conservative media, conservative consultants and speakers, and there's a lot of room for a former politician and a former leader to continue to exert influence, even if they're not formally in the halls of power. And it's a little like people talk about Jimmy Carter crafting the post-presidency, and how do you do that and remain significant? There's ways in which Gingrich has shown how you can do that in the world of conservative politics. And that influence went all the way to the White House, including right now, as we record this, I know Gingrich is consulting with the former president about strategies for the midterm campaigns,
right,
and other sorts of issues. It was just reported in the news. So he shows that you don't have to have office indefinitely, and you could still remain a powerhouse in the party.
Well, it's a very distressing sort of picture, but of course, this is the Professor Buzzkill show, so we have to point out when things are bad. Of course, we hope that it will change, but the one thing we want to definitely say is thank you very much for coming on the show. It's very kind of you. You're a CNN contributor. You're a contributor to other major media, so I know your time is very valuable, but it's been extremely useful for our listeners to hear this.
Thank you very much. It was a great conversation.
Well, there you have it, Buzzkillers. Before we go, I'd like to remind everyone to go to ProfessorBuzzkill.com for all the info about the show, to read the blog posts, to catch up on past episodes, to follow us on social media, and to support the Buzzkill Institute on Patreon. Please become part of the solution to history myths and misconceptions, rather than perpetuating the problem of retelling historical urban legends. History is complex, but it's also compelling. And when we study it more fully, we can come to a better understanding of ourselves, our societies, and perhaps even our future. And we want to say to the Buzzkillers out there that we will talk to all of you next week.